Hey everyone, this is The Takeaway and I'm Tanzina Vega, and today we start on Capitol Hill.
I rise today to announce that I think Robert Wilkie is the right man for the job to be VA Secretary.
Mr. Wilkie, I think you're the right man for the job.
It was clear to me from the start he was destined to serve the nation at a higher level.
I look forward to your confirmation.
You've got a varied background, and I believe that you'll serve well.
On Monday, the Senate voted 86-9 to confirm Robert Wilkie as Secretary for Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Wilkie is the son of a veteran. His father was wounded in Vietnam. He grew up on the battlefields of the South, learning about military history, Confederate history, and he had a real affinity for that history.
That was Lisa Ryan from The Washington Post, and we'll hear more from her in a bit. But now, Wilkie is a longtime government official with decades of experience in several government agencies. And it's experience that he'll need as he prepares to take charge of a staff of 360,000 employees. It's the second largest agency in government, responsible for providing service to over 9 million veterans enrolled in its healthcare program. But the VA hasn't had a leader for nearly 4 months after President Trump fired the previous Secretary David Shulkin in March. Here's the president addressing the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention earlier today.
Somebody bad mistreats or neglects or abuses our great veterans in their time of need. We can turn to them, look at them in the eye and say, "You're fired. Get out. Get out."
At the time, Dr. Shulkin was the only holdover from the Obama administration to serve in President Trump's cabinet. He was confirmed 100-0 in the Senate in February 2017, but he was fired shortly into his second year as VA secretary. And we have him here today. Dr. David Shulkin, welcome to The Takeaway.
I'm glad to be here.
So we'll start off with the news of the day. Robert Wilkie was overwhelmingly confirmed in a vote in the Senate last night. What's your sense of his readiness for the position?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody's ever ready for this position. This is one of the most complex jobs in government, one of the most important, but I certainly offer my congratulations to Secretary Wilkie. It's an honor of a lifetime to be able to serve as secretary, and I hope and wish that he is going to be very successful at this position.
And what do you see as some of the, I mean, are there specific challenges that you think Wilkie should prepare for within this administration?
Well, I think the way that any new secretary, any new executive who enters a position has to focus on the things that are most important. And I do believe that there are several issues that I think the secretary needs to make sure that he's addressing. And of course, he'll bring his own priorities to the job. But number one has to be access to care. Secondly, I had identified as the single top clinical priority the suicide issue among veterans. It's just an astounding figure that I hope nobody ever gets used to of 20 veterans a day taking their life, and I think that needs to stay focused on. And then there are two or three other issues. This choice program is a big deal. You know, Congress and the president just approved a major reform of that program. I had been working on that for close to 3 years. That's probably the biggest implementation anywhere in the country ever done. And so that's going to take a focus.
And you mentioned staffing, and that's been a huge issue at the VA. It's been reported that there are more than 33,000 job vacancies. What do you expect, or how do you expect Wilkie will be able to address these issues of staffing? You mentioned that's important, but how is one expected to do that with what I would assume is a certain amount of morale drain at this point?
Yeah, I think that there are really two issues both contributing to this problem of vacancies in the VA. One, as you mentioned, is the morale. Look, change of leadership at the top is never good for an organization and certainly not good for veterans. This is the fourth secretary in 5 years, and this constant churn of people at the top is simply destroying the morale of the organization and taking its focus off of where it needs to be, which is back on helping veterans. And so I certainly hope that Secretary Wilkie is there for a while, that there gets to be continuity of leadership, that he focuses in on the workforce and on building up that morale. The second issue that I think is contributing to these vacancies is what's happening in the rest of healthcare outside the VA. This is an area where there is increasingly healthcare staff shortages throughout the country, and the VA has to compete. And if the VA is not a modern system with competitive salaries and competitive tools and a place where people feel proud of working, they're going to have a hard time filling those positions.
And of course, Dr. Shulkin, let's talk about your own tenure. You were unanimously confirmed once for undersecretary under President Obama, and then you were unanimously confirmed again for secretary under President Trump, and then you were fired. What happened?
Yes. Well, look, I think it's so important that VA not be viewed in a political environment. Now, that's a funny thing to say in Washington, but in my experience, I was able to work with both sides of the aisle. I looked at issues in a bipartisan way, kept the politics as much as I could out of it. There were, unfortunately, political appointees in the Trump administration who I don't think had veterans' interests in the forefront, who were interested in the politics of it. I always said when I went to Washington that I was going to stand for what I believed in, and if that was going to cost me my job, that's what was going to happen. And so I left holding the principles of my job every day I was there was to do what was right for veterans. And I feel proud of that record. And I certainly hope that Secretary Wilkie will continue along that way. He said the right things at the hearings. I don't know him personally, but I will do everything I can to help him. I know former secretaries will too. And it's very important that he bring this back to a apolitical issue, because there is no greater mission in our federal government than to take care of these brave men and women.
So one of the things that came up during your departure was that it came pretty close to an inspector general's report that looked at, as you're aware of, an official trip to Europe, the trip that cost over $120,000. Would you care to respond to that today?
Oh, this was an official invite. $120,000, you have to remember, that's for 10 people for a 9.5-day trip. Everything that was done was completely pre-approved by the ethics officials, done according to policy. This is what I'm talking about, the political environment, taking issues that really shouldn't be issues, turning them into things that don't focus on what matters to veterans, and I just wasn't going to have any part of that. And I wasn't going to go along with the Washington Games. And so I kept focused on working towards veterans. And I think that we've made a lot of progress that a new secretary can continue with. It doesn't have to be exactly the way that I was doing it, of course, and I wouldn't expect it to be. But I think that we focused on those issues that this country needs to address in order to fulfill its responsibility to our country's veterans.
Dr. David Shulkin is former Secretary of Veteran Affairs from 2017 to 2018. Doctor, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Now let's talk about the man who will follow Dr. Shulkin. Robert Wilkie emphasized the ongoing need for change at the VA when he was questioned by senators at a confirmation hearing late last month.
As Secretary Mattis said when this Congress passed a $700 billion defense budget, there are no more excuses. You, and the ranking member, have infused VA with a $200 billion budget. You have passed the Accountability Act to shake up complacency, and you have passed the Mission Act to bring institutional VA, community care, and caregivers closer together. The future now is up to the department.
But whether the VA's problems are political or institutional or both, will Robert Wilkie's appointment to Trump's cabinet be enough to correct the agency's course? We're going to ask Lisa Ryan about that. She's a reporter with The Washington Post, but she starts with Wilkie's background.
Wilkie is from North Carolina, and his first job after graduating from college was to work for the very infamous Senator Jesse Helms, who was his senior senator from his home state, who was a very racially divisive figure. And he then worked for Trent Lott in the 90s. The time was the Senate Majority Leader. He then worked for Donald Rumsfeld, the architect of the Iraq War. Both Trent Lott and Jesse Helms were figures who were very much on one side, on the right side of the culture wars of the 90s. And so the question for Wilkie when he went into his nomination hearing from Democrats was, will you be able to serve all veterans? Because you have worked for some divisive figures, and the veteran population is very, very diverse now. Women are the fastest growing group. There are African-American veterans. It's very diverse. And I think he was very much able to convince the Senate committee that he would be able to serve all veterans. And he was almost unanimously voted out of the Senate yesterday.
So in terms of when the Senate panel voted to proceed with Wilkie's confirmation hearing last month, Bernie Sanders expressed concerns that the Trump administration was looking to privatize the VA.
Do you believe in the privatization of the VA? That's question number one.
No, sir. No, Senator, I don't.
Okay. Will you vigorously oppose, whether it is the Koch brothers and their various organizations or the President of the United States, any effort to privatize the VA?
My commitment to you is that I will oppose efforts to privatize VA.
Is that a valid concern from Bernie Sanders?
I think it's partly a semantics question. So under the Trump administration, and this started with Dr. Shulkin, it started even in the Obama administration, after a scandal over fudged wait lists, patient wait lists for care, it became clear that VA could not handle the increased demand for care from returning veterans from Iraq, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and from Vietnam-era veterans whose health is getting sicker as they age. And so VA has been gradually outsourcing more care. And under Trump, the portion of care that has been outsourced has grown to about 36%. And this is what Bernie Sanders is talking about, because for Democrats and for labor unions who represent VA employees, this feels like a slow drip of efforts to carve VA out of a government healthcare system to a private one. But Trump appointees say, look, we are not privatizing. Privatizing is the wrong word. Privatizing means that you're taking the government system and you're making it wholly private. And clearly that is not happening. It's just, it's really a continuum, but it is more satisfactory to the Trump administration, which, you know, in general, is more favorable and toward private care.
Well, and also we saw that the confirmation, Wilkie's confirmation, did not include 9 senators. And I'm wondering if that had to do with this issue of privatization.
I think largely it did, although I think their no votes also reflected just the politicization and partisanship of cabinet nominees and confirmations in the Trump era. So many of these 9 senators, Kamala Harris of California, Bernie Sanders, of course, of Vermont, Cory Booker of New Jersey, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, are potential nominees for the presidential, for president. And many of them have been no votes on a lot of Trump's cabinet nominees. VA, though, this was really a departure for VA, because every modern VA secretary has won unanimous confirmation in the Senate. But here, I do think the issue is the threat of, shall we say, privatization.
Lisa Rhine covers federal agencies for The Washington Post. Lisa, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
We head overseas now on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. We haven't talked a lot about the Islamic State lately on the show, but across northern Syria, 1,000 foreign fighters from nearly 50 countries are being held in a handful of wartime prisons, evidence of the ongoing fight against ISIS.
The big fear as ISIS collapses and the caliphate collapses is that all these people from all around the world who were zealots and ideologues and went to Syria to join this terrorist country, essentially, will slip back to their home countries and cause a tremendous security risk.
New York Times Washington correspondent Charlie Savage had the opportunity to tour 2 of the prisons alongside a congressional delegation. This tour was the first of its kind and gives a rare insight into places that detain captured ISIS fighters.
We're talking about prisons that are run by the Kurds, sometimes called the Syrian Democratic Forces, and those are the Americans' primary ally in Syria who are on the ground fighting the Islamic State as we provide air power. And so they've done a lot of heavy fighting for us, and as part of that, well, for themselves as well. And as part of that, they've been capturing Islamic State fighters, as well as women and children who were associated with the so-called caliphate. And they put the women and children in internally displaced persons camps, kind of like refugee camps, and reporters can visit those. They have not been letting reporters come tour their prisons for the men, who they call foreign fighters. They have about 7 prisons for male fighters, and we looked at 2 of them. One of them is one of several school buildings that have been converted into makeshift prisons, and they've reinforced the doors of the classrooms and put bars on the windows with U.S. help in terms of funding for these improvements, added big concrete walls that are 2 stories tall surrounding it. And then the men are mostly in group cells. So there's 15, 20 guys inside each of these classrooms sort of lined up in a row, hundreds of them crammed into this school, and no one really knowing what's going to happen to them because their home countries are not taking them back, and the SDF is not a country, it's just an organization, a militia, and for now they're just warehousing them. The second place we went to is a real prison, a government prison that was built in the 1960s and then taken over by ISIS for a while and now taken over by the Kurds in a town called Hasaka. So this looks like a prison. It's got concrete walls and very narrow windows and much better security. It has a dark history, as you might imagine, being run by the Syrian regime and then ISIS. But they've painted it white, and they're trying to fix it up and make it a more humane place. It's also going to be mainly group cells, and when they are ready to open that next month, they think they can bring about 1,000 men there to consolidate their prisoners of war. But it still won't be enough. They don't have room for all the prisoners they're taking, and that's why they're desperate to get other countries to start taking their people back.
Now, were you able to speak to any of the prisoners or any of the guards?
No, well, I was not allowed to speak to prisoners at the one prison that was occupied, and that was in the town called Ain Issa. This was the schoolhouse prison we visited. I asked and it was denied. We did speak to people who were running the prisons, however. Both the future warden of the Hasaka prison that's getting ready to accept detainees and a SDF, Syrian Kurd, intelligence official who oversees 2 of the prisons, including that are currently occupied, including the one we walked through. And they described what they're doing, who they're holding there, what their approach is, the problems they're having, and generally tried to make a positive impression in terms of saying they were trying to respect human rights, not just because it's the right thing to do, but as a strategic matter, as a tactical matter, to try to deprogram and de-radicalize these detainees who are caught up in ISIS, but maybe at a low level.
Now, you went to these facilities with a congressional delegation. Could you tell us who went on the trip and also how much money and U.S. government resources are going towards supporting these prisons?
The delegation consisted of 2 lawmakers on the Senate Armed Services Committee, a Republican, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and a Democrat, Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire. And then on the trip, once we went in through Baghdad. We were joined by very senior military officials involved in the coalition that is fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, including General Paul Funk, who's the overall commander of the operations there. As far as what the United States is spending, I think relative to what we're spending on war in general, it seems to be a really relatively modest amount of money. What I was told was so far about $1.6 million from military funds has been gone to help the Kurds shore up security at these prisons. So they paid for hiring a contractor to come assemble this towering concrete perimeter wall around the Ain Issa prison that we visited, for example. Last fall, there was a breakout there where some detainees got out through a hole, and this kind of security is intended to keep those on the inside in and those on the outside from breaking in. They're also adding security cameras and some interior gates in the hallways, but about $1 million, $1.5 million is what taxpayers in the United States are spending so far to try to help the Kurds keep these people from escaping.
You mentioned there are some countries that have dozens of citizens in these prisons and they don't want them to come back home. What makes more sense, keeping them there or trying to get them back to their home country so they can then be prosecuted?
It's a little bit unclear how many of these people can be prosecuted. And of course, each country has its own legal system and its own rules. And there's all kinds of complexities about whether they can prosecute someone who was not extradited from a foreign government, but just handed over by a non-state actor like the Kurds. And generally, I think the attitude seems to be they left us, they went over there, we're going to wash our hands of them. We don't want the headache of having to deal with them and figure out a way to, you know, figure out who's dangerous and who's not and keep an eye on them. It just sounds like a giant problem. The downside, though, the risk to the world right now is that it's not at all clear that the Kurds, the SDF, has the capacity to hold on to these people forever. These prisons didn't seem to be as bad as one might have expected. Maybe with American help, they looked fairly secure. At some point, if the United States pulls out, as President Trump has been saying he sure would like to do, it doesn't seem likely that the Kurds will be able to hold on to their territory and the prisons within it forever. And at some point, they will either make a deal with Assad or they'll be rolled over or something. And then the question is, what will happen to all these presumably dangerous people? So that's part of the reason why counterterrorism experts, at least in the U.S. government, want each country to take responsibility for its nationals, for its citizens, and reduce that problem by sort of dividing it up and saying, bring them home, prosecute them if you can, or at least keep an eye on them, rather than having it sitting there as kind of a time bomb.
Charlie Savage is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Washington correspondent for the New York Times and the author of Power Wars. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You know what? 18 years I'm in this business with the Daily News. I'm here at the Daily News. I have my first front page in 1983.
It's been my life for almost 6 years, and I feel very privileged to get to have gotten to work with some of the best in the business.
I am grateful. I am very grateful to the Daily News.
I feel like I grew up at the Daily News.
That was photographer Todd Mizell and reporter Chelsea Marcia speaking to the Associated Press as they left the New York Daily News offices. On Monday morning, it was announced that half of the editorial staff of the paper would be laid off, including Mizell and Marcias, as well as big names like Mike Lupica and Frank Isola. This comes months after the paper was sold to large media conglomerate Tronc, which owns other local newspapers around the United States. Jacqueline Pizer is a media reporter at the New York Times. Jacqueline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tough layoffs yesterday,
yeah.
And we're seeing this across the spectrum in media, left and right, particularly with newspapers. Let's talk a little bit about the specifics. What beats or sections were hit the hardest at the Daily News?
Sure. Well, the sports section was totally gutted. I mean, it went from, I believe, 35 reporters to 9, including some legendary columnists, like you mentioned. Social media team is pretty much gone. What's interesting is that they fired the head of the breaking news department, even though they say they want to boost up breaking news. It's just pretty much a shell of what it was before.
Let's talk a little bit about the Daily News, the New York Daily News. I am a native New Yorker, born and raised in this city. My dad read the news every day, still reads the news, and doesn't even live in New York anymore. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what this paper represents in New York City for New Yorkers.
Sure. I mean, the Daily News was available, or maybe still is available, in every borough in the city, every neighborhood. Anyone has access to the Daily News. And it was really a draw for the working class and for immigrants. And it spoke to what was impacting those people. And I think it really resonated with a lot of them. And it's also the size of the Daily News. I mean, people that take the subway, it's small enough to be able to read sitting down, standing up on a crowded subway on a platform. That alone speaks to its draw to the masses of New York.
Let's talk about who owns the Daily News.
Sure.
There's a company called Tronc. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about them.
So Tronc is a media company based out of Chicago. They own the Chicago Tribune. They own the Baltimore Sun. And until recently, they owned the Los Angeles Times. And Tronc has a habit of bringing in people into leadership that are more from a business perspective than from a journalism perspective, which has never really come across well to a lot of the employees at these newspapers. They're really focused on how can we get more people to come to our website, because they believe that's the best business model, is to get more advertising on digital, which we've seen is the future of journalism. But at the same time, I think there's this disconnect of, you know, creating this original reporting and beat reporting and things that appeal to the local communities that these papers are based in that draw in readers.
So as a news consumer, not just a journalist myself, but as a news consumer, I'm very concerned about what this means to news consumers outside of, you know, New York and even within New York. It's just I'm concerned about the inability for these companies to put money aside to do the thing that they would like their companies to do, i.e. journalism.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't they get $500 million from the LA Times sale? Like, hasn't there been a lot of money being moved around and these companies just can't seem to put it towards the journalists? What's up with that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's the big question. It's like, if there are a media publishing company, why isn't that money going to fund their media and their journalism? I personally don't understand why they find the interest in buying these media companies if they don't care about journalism.
And just this idea that you want people to click, but you're not going to give them anything to click on, sort of feels hollow to me.
Yeah.
It just, I don't quite understand that. But, and again, I guess we'll watch and see what happens. Jacqueline Pizer is a reporter covering media for the New York Times. Jacqueline, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sinclair Broadcast Group is one of the largest owners of local TV stations in the United States. It reaches just under 40% of U.S. households, and it's gained a reputation for requiring local news to air programming with a right-wing bias. The company had planned to increase its reach through a merger with Tribune Media, but in a ruling last week, the Federal Communications Commission moved to block the merger. Brian Fung has been covering this story for The Washington Post, and he's here to help us break it down. Brian, how are you?
Doing great, thanks.
So tell us, what was the FCC's objection to the merger?
Well, there are a number of issues with the Sinclair merger that the FCC is looking at. The biggest one has to do with some station sales that Sinclair wants to make in order to comply with FCC regulations once the deal is done.
And we should mention to our listeners that WNYC President and CEO Laura Walker does sit on the board of Tribune Media, and her office declined our request for comment. Brian, what's been FCC's chairman Ajit Pai's record so far in terms of broadcast regulations? Because we know that they were looking at the AT&T Time Warner merger, and now they're sort of looking at this. Tell us a little bit about the track record.
So Chairman Pai has done a lot in his first couple of years here at the FCC as chairman to roll back regulations on the broadcast industry. And some of the ways he's done that is by repealing rules that, you know, for example, required broadcasters to operate a physical studio in the markets in which they hold a license. You know, other changes include making it easier for stations in the same market to merge and survive and compete against other larger broadcasters. All of these moves ended up benefiting Sinclair as it tried to get approval for its deal. The thought was that Sinclair could use these regulations to more easily comply with FCC regulations once its deal was done.
So Sinclair, as we mentioned in the introduction, has come under fire for having its reporters in some local news outlets, forcing them essentially to read what many would consider to be right-wing propaganda and not necessarily journalism. Did that have any role in the FCC's decision to block this merger?
Well, the FCC has been pretty mum about, you know, the specifics of any kind of programming that Sinclair may have, you know, put on the air. That doesn't appear to be at issue here. What's at issue is that Sinclair offered to sell a number of stations to people who are said to be pretty close to Sinclair, and that potential conflict of interest raised some questions at the FCC, which are now being forwarded to an administrative law judge, which is typically the FCC's first move it makes when it wants to block a merger.
And also, let's say this does end up happening, or what could the impact be on American media consumers? Is it better for the merger to go through? Is it better for it to be paused and wait to see what happens? What's the impact on the media consumer?
Well, to answer that, we should probably step back and talk a little bit about what the initial merger proposal would have meant for consumers. And it would have essentially allowed Sinclair to access as many as 72% of U.S. households. And that's far above a national cap that the FCC has in place that's set at 39% of U.S. households. So all of this, you know, figuring out which station Sinclair is going to sell off and what types of rules Sinclair will have to live by after the merger. It's all designed to make sure that Sinclair stays below that 39% cap. But that's still a pretty substantial portion of the U.S. population.
And I guess we'll be paying attention to see what their next moves are.
That's right. Even though the FCC has sent this merger or key parts of it to administrative law judge, Sinclair still has an opportunity to try and argue that this should be thrown out.
Brian Fung is a reporter at The Washington Post. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
All this week on The Takeaway, we've got a series called Hysterical, Women and Rage. And lots of you had something to say.
Hi, my name is Tanya, and I'm calling from Tampa, Florida.
This is Lois. I'm calling from Harlem.
Lisa from Homewood, Illinois.
Susan from Anchorage, Alaska.
No, I'm not allowed to express my anger at work. I either get reprimanded.
The last time I expressed anger, I basically freaked everybody out who witnessed it.
I'm stuck trying to get by without speaking up for myself, which is very hard for me. I'm not ready to make nice. I'm not ready to back down.
I'm still mad as hell and I don't have time to go round and round and round.
I find that if I express my anger with words that might include an expletive, I find that I am immediately criticized for using the expletive, and my message is never goes beyond that.
As a professional black woman in my 60s, I cannot begin to enumerate the myriad consequences of expressing my anger.
I wanted to conduct an experiment to test an assumption I was hearing a lot about in the news that women might get backlash when they express anger.
That's Jessica Salerno, a psychology professor at Arizona State University.
So I looked at this in the context of a group decision-making situation, specifically jury deliberation.
So basically, the setup was this. The participant would read the facts supporting the case and then make a decision. That person would then be introduced to a group of fellow jurors in an online chat room. The catch? Those other participants were plants working from a controlled script.
So we set it up so that whatever opinion the participant had, once they started deliberating with their group online, they learned that everyone agreed with them except for one person, that there was a dissenting holdout who was trying to convince the group to change their mind.
That holdout would either have a male or female name and would deliver their arguments in a calm or angry tone.
We added some capital letters and some exclamation points and some statements of anger so that they got the impression that the holdout juror was angry.
And then Jessica and her colleagues crunched the numbers.
When the holdout was expressing no emotion at all, that holdout was able to convince people to change their verdict, to change their mind, about 7% of the time, regardless of it, whether they were a male or female holdout. But when they expressed anger, we saw that the men were able to change, that went from 7% to 18%. So they're about 2.5 times more likely to make people change their mind when they expressed anger. But for the women, we saw that when they expressed anger, it dropped to 0. So when women expressed anger, not one person in that condition changed their mind.
And those results were the same for both male and female participants.
The takeaway here is that when men express anger, that anger leads to influence over other people. People saw him as more competent and commanding, and that made them doubt their own opinion and gave him influence. But when a woman expresses the same anger and the same opinions, we found that that hurts her. So they saw her as more emotional and then led her to have less influence over their opinion.
Now, of course, there's another study that you have coming out soon. It's similar to the 2015 study, but this one is focused on attorneys. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so my previous study and most research tends to look at contexts where we aren't supposed to be expressing emotion, like juries, the workplace. I wanted to see if there might be an exception for women that they might be able to get away with expressing anger when it's a profession or a workplace where you're supposed to express emotion. So attorneys are supposed to express their opinions in court with indignation and anger because it shows that they have conviction about their case. So in the next study, instead of jurors, we showed people videotapes of a bunch of actors, or they were real lawyers, but acting being in a courtroom and delivering a closing statement either in a calm manner or in an angry manner. And again, we had both male and female attorneys. And so we found, unfortunately, the same pattern where people wanted to hire angry male attorneys significantly more than calm male attorneys. But we saw the opposite for women. So they wanted to hire angry female attorneys significantly less than the calm version of the female attorney. So again, we see that men are more effective when they express anger and women are less effective when they express anger, even in a context where anger is expected and appropriate.
Are there any positives to women being angry in the workplace at all?
Basically, I think the implications of this is that things are very complicated for women in the workplace because if they don't express, if they are, particularly when they're in a profession where they're trying to persuade people and have influence, emotion is a really key part of doing that successfully. So unfortunately, they're stuck where if they don't express emotion, they might be seen as weak or not powerful, not assertive. But if they do express a traditionally masculine trait like expressing anger, then they get backlash. And I think, unfortunately, that might lead women to think that they shouldn't express anger anymore. And I think that that would be unfortunate because that is going to contribute to the overall problem, which is that there are these gender norms against women expressing anger that need to change. And I think one positive aspect of the recent Me Too movement is really interesting because that is a very large-scale movement of women expressing a lot of anger and actually seeing some shift and some movement. And I think part of that might be because of the Me Too aspect of this is that they're showing that this is a common experience and a common sentiment. And it's a lot harder to put a woman in the box of the crazy, ranting, hysterical woman when it's one person, when you have a large number of women expressing this and probably people that they know. So hopefully, although there might be some backlash of women expressing anger, hopefully an upside would be that eventually the norms will change and we won't see as much backlash.
I guess what's frustrating to me, and I'm sure other women, is that we even have to have this conversation about what should we do as women to mitigate our natural emotions. The idea that we cannot just express, that the rest of the world won't adapt, that it's women that then have to adapt to these outdated gender norms, as you're suggesting, is difficult.
Absolutely. And that was one of the sort of inspirations for running the first study that I'm sure no woman is surprised to hear the results of. But often I think when women try to state that this is a real thing, people often dismiss it as paranoia, or they talk about how, well, women just don't express anger as effectively, or their voices are shrill, or, well, they're not making good arguments and they're using this as an excuse. And I wanted to have data that we could say, no, when you hold everything constant, this is just because they think the anger is coming from a man or a woman. There's also, I think, an aspect of this where people think the anger is coming from a different place from a man versus a woman. So when women express anger, people tend to think it's because of something internal to her. She is an emotional person. There's something inside of her that is unhinged. Whereas for men, research shows that people tend to assume there's an external and valid cause for it. So, well, he's angry because he's convicted about the case, or he's angry because he had a bad day. It's not something about him. So, you know, I think we really need to change this perception that anger isn't a naturally occurring thing in women. You know, it's a human emotion. It's not a male emotion.
And then we have a bonus question for you, Jessica, and we're asking all the women we're interviewing this week, is whether or not you have a favorite song by a woman or by women to rage to.
Oh, great question. This is when I was growing up, when I was younger, this was my rage song was Mother Mother by Tracy Bonham.
Mother Mother.
Oh my God, I just said that.
Did you?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, it is. That's a good one.
Fantastic. Jessica Salerno is a psychology professor at Arizona State University. Jessica, really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mother, mother.
So Jessica Salerno and I have the same favorite song by a woman to rage to. What's yours? Tweet us at The Takeaway and we want to add it to our Spotify list. Now, thanks to Takeaway listener Dr. Turfel on Twitter for giving us the suggestion of Not Ready to Make Nice by the Dixie Chicks, which we played at the beginning of the story. And tomorrow, ladies, we're talking specifically about what happens when you get angry in the workplace. Women, do you have a story of getting mad at work? What happened? And was it different than when a male colleague got mad? We really want to hear your stories, so thanks so much for listening. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Tweet me at Tanzina Vega. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm hungry. I'm dirty. I'm losing my mind. I'm freezing. I'm
starving. I'm bleeding to death. Everything's mine. Yeah, I'm working, making money.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.